So I don't have any disclosures to make. So this presentation, and I'd like to thank my co-authors, Lana Hayes and Evelina, for their work on a comprehensive literature review of how youth-friendly services are being implemented and also effectively how it became also a literature review of the evaluation methodologies for youth-friendly services globally. IPAS works predominantly in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and now is also doing some work in the Middle East as well. So one of the things that we found in these studies was that there was a lack of focus even on reviews and write-ups of about youth-friendly services. There was a lack of focus on young people themselves. Very few young people were actually interviewed to find out about how the services were being provided and what young people thought about them. So the first question is, why focus on young women when we're talking about abortion? And we know that in many parts of the world, the people who are experiencing unsafe abortions, about half tend to be women under the age of 24, and that's the global average, and varies regionally up as high as 60% of young women being under the age of 24 who are experiencing unsafe abortions. Also, the mortality rates from unsafe abortions are very disproportionately represented in young women. About half of global deaths from unsafe abortion are women who are under the age of 24. So as far as a strategic target population, we know that if we're able to impact the way that women under the age of 24 are able to access services, then we can have a big impact on maternal mortality or mortality and injury based on unsafe abortion. So what are the things that we saw in the literature review in terms of what youth-friendly services provide is that they had an over-focus on service delivery itself, providers, training providers, or the facilities themselves, logistics, such as providing a special entrance for young people, certain hours that the clinic was available only to young people so that they wouldn't have to run into older members of their community. There was a strong focus on cosmetics, what kinds of magazines you have in the waiting room, if there are posters of pop stars in the waiting room. And there was very little focus on participation, but the few youth-friendly models that were being set up that did involve youth participation generally had some sort of a peer education element that was connected with them. And usually the peer education element seemed to come up as an after-the-fact thought when they found out that a lot of young people didn't actually know that their services were available, so it was sort of more of a marketing type of way of approaching youth participation. So what did young people prioritize? We did find a small body of literature that specifically interviewed young people and spoke with young people about their experiences with sexual and reproductive health. Some of these studies were done within a clinic setting. Many of the studies were done just targeting the young people in a geographic area in the city or across a school district to just ask what their reproductive health needs were and try to find out what would make for positive youth services for them. Young people prioritized really different things. Very few, there wasn't a single study where a young person's first thought was, I just hope that that medical provider's really trained on how to deal with my body that's different from a woman's body who's 30. So our primary concerns as providers are not young people's primary concerns necessarily. They were concerned with being treated with respect. Many of them used the word negative provider experience or attitudes. They were concerned with confidentiality and privacy, and they were concerned also with making reproductive health services appealing. So integrating in the same location access to the internet, job training, other things that young people needed or felt like were appropriate and timely for them that would enable them to come to a space without stigma and be able to access other resources that they could find useful. So a quote from a Ugandan youth leader. He says, most service providers are not youth friendly. For example, someone comes here, a girl of 14. Imagine a service provider says, even at your age, you started doing this? Imagine immediately that one will never come back, and even tell others, you don't go there. These adolescents, you have to appreciate it is hard to come in, even when what they want to discuss is confidential. Some of these service providers will go and share these things with people outside, and these adolescents come to know about it. Something small like that can spread very, very fast, and the other people will never come back. So that's, I think, a quick and salient example of something that happens all over the world. And what are the results? So young people then won't go to those providers. Someone who went to get information may not even ask the next question of, well, I also have itching, what could that be about? Because they're not going to pursue another beratement from the provider. It reinforces stigma. It forces young people to travel great distances that other people may not be pushed to travel because they're seeking the anonymity or just seeking the next provider over, which might be far away. It eliminates at least one safe space for reporting sexual violence. You're not very likely to respond by divulging more vulnerable information after you've had that initial experience with a provider. And you've lost one of your great access points for accurate information about birth control and sexually transmitted infections and diseases. So we know that the consequences are very serious. Another thing that young people prioritized is being able to imagine sexual and reproductive health services as being both within the clinic and in the community. Because stigma was such a huge issue, some of the projects that were more successful actually weren't based out of clinics at all, but were based out of the local school district, getting teachers and parents and young people involved in peer education projects. And then that had a huge translation into people actually pursuing information and services from the clinics. So how do we move forward with this somewhat grim vision? There are about 14 to 20 published papers right now that actually include youth voices about how we're providing services, sexual and reproductive health services for young people worldwide. And so we need more research. And we need to incorporate into our research youth voices, both as the people who design the research questions and ask the research questions and the people who are answering them. Some of the basics, we also want to know what people think, what young people's needs are, what are the most negative impacts on their ability to reach out to a provider, what are the social barriers in their particular community. And what we came to is a real need to rethink this concept of youth-friendly and think about the word friendly. Do we want youth-friendly services? What does that mean? It's not really a word that reflects the fact that, particularly with abortion care, this is a primary target population to be able to assist with access to safe services. We want services that are inclusive. We want services that are accessible for young people, but really they're just the same services and appropriate for young people. So part of our recommendation is to get away from this concept of thinking of youth as a small, homogeneous subset that we can somehow address in a specialized way, but also that we need to incorporate young people as stakeholders throughout the process. So it's not just about research, it's also about participation in design of programs, in monitoring and evaluation, in implementation of programs. Some of the buzzwords happening in our field right now are participatory action research or youth-adult partnerships. Youth-adult partnerships have been around since the 80s, but there's not a lot written about them. So it's also still an approach that's, we don't have a huge body of literature about it. But it's basically these buzzwords are for these practices of incorporating youth participation throughout the process of program design. So one of the other primary things we need to be able to do is recognize that young people are not a homogenous group. They're married, they're single, they're parents, they're not parents, all sexual orientations. The age range legally of a young person across the globe varies dramatically. So in South Africa, for example, you can still be a young person for purposes of healthcare up to the age of 36. We're not, you know, shooting for that, but I like that number. But we need to realize that when we're talking about young people, just because they're young, it doesn't mean that it's all one group. Just like any other general population that we're trying to serve, we have to be able to think of all of the variety of needs. So that also means that solutions need to be designed locally. Just a couple of really quick examples. I know I would like to leave a few minutes for questions, but a couple of quick examples. Some youth-driven projects that we've seen. Some groups of young women have gotten together in several different countries in Latin America to create hotlines so that other young people can anonymously access information about medical abortion. They're not providing any healthcare services, but they are working closely with providers to ensure that they're giving accurate information over the hotlines. This is tricky business. They're working in places that where abortion is very restricted, but these are grassroots movements of young people saying, we're sick of not having access to information and not having services, so we're just gonna make it happen for ourselves. I think it's an inspiring model to think about and think about how we can tap into some of that energy to inform our work. So just one more thing I just wanted to say before closing is that in the process of doing this research, I also am struck by globally how little information we have, like the information that we heard from previous presenters with very detailed information that we're able to break out and identify in these heterogeneous groups, how can we provide better services? So really the best model in the field without having that kind of information is participatory. You have to have young people involved in the projects. And I encourage you all to be skeptical of large dollar funding projects that are coming into Nepal, some of the countries that are getting big money right now from DFID and from other programs. I encourage you to not be skeptical of the programs because they're great, but to push them to involve young people as stakeholders from the get-go and encourage them to ensure that they have throughout their monitoring and evaluation process data that they're collecting about the experience of these very important recipients and participants in the services. I also wanted to just let you all know that the literature review is not currently published, but if anyone would like a copy of it, just let me know. I'd be happy to send it to you. Any questions?
Yeah. I have one point of shameless promotion.
Yeah, please.
One of the reasons we know so very little about young people in the abortion context is because institutional review boards are very, very restrictive in the participation. We're doing a study right now looking at the impact of IRBs on research involving adolescents in the abortion context. If you had any experience, whether it's self-censorship that you've done or censoring that you had done by an IRB, please contact someone at answer.org and we would love to talk to you because it's not just about not knowing, it's also about we're highly restricted in trying to collect this information.
Sure. I would also add that we're also working on another project that looks at the intersection of legal frameworks and young people's access to safe legal abortion in several different countries in Africa and Asia right now. I don't have results yet or a final paper yet on that. But one of the things that we found is that without even talking about abortion law, we can positively impact young people's access to legal abortion by looking at age of consent laws in the health law, which is a general age of consent for a medical procedure. Oftentimes, the age of consent for a medical procedure is 18, but you can get married at 16 or inherit property at 16. So there are some discords in terms of where women are in their lives and what they're able to consent to on their own.
I just wanted to mention one other resource, and it just strikes me that it's you're talking about an international context, but it's so relevant for us here. And just wanted to mention that in New York City, we've undertaken a long process, but has really paid off to develop what we call a teen guide to sexual health, but it's really identified through mystery shopper calls using teens to develop a really cute, small, kind of wallet size, team-friendly looking guide that really highlights the places throughout our five boroughs that are friendly, what types of services are offered there, whether abortion is offered, whether they're LGBT friendly, et cetera. And I'd be happy to share information with anyone who's interested in that too.
Great. I would just add that this is a really cool booklet, similar to that booklet that was created by a group of young people who founded an organization called Decidir in Mexico City. Similar idea. So that's, I think, a wonderful type of project to encourage.
I'm interested in these grassroots movements to get information out, and also if you know of any countries, developing countries, where they've used mass media in any way to kind of, you know, despite the taboos, to somehow find ways to advertise.
I haven't seen people advertising services, but IPAS, if you go to IPAS's page on YouTube, you can see a couple of different projects. One is in Brazil, and it's just a very quick 30-second spot asking people on the street, do you think abortion is wrong? Yes. Do you think abortion should be illegal? Absolutely. Should someone have to go to jail for having an abortion? Oh, well. It's really powerful. So that's one campaign. And then we've also seen some campaigns that we actually participated in Central America, where abortion is very restricted, in Nicaragua in particular, where some pop stars, music and writers, got involved and did a big ad campaign on television that was basically an anti-stigma campaign, saying it's not okay for women to die because we're not willing to talk about this. So those are some examples, but that also has its risks.
Can I add to that? In Mexico City, there's actually been these ad campaigns in the metros where they advertise the services, and there's an information hotline that you can call in. And also, I think they're doing a lot of kind of mass media efforts, especially this organization here.
Yeah.
And just to add to that, I mean, some of the campaigns that they did, the ads that they did in Mexico, were really innovative, like appropriating the language of the other side. I mean, they had one that was like, pro-life means, you know, having a family that we can take care of and stuff like that. And sort of framing the right to abortion within a pro-life stance. There have been a few other campaigns in other places in Latin America. I know in Uruguay there was one of just encouraging women to come out saying that they had had an abortion,
Yeah. I would just add, that just reminded me that in Mexico City, they also did this fabulous flyer that's just, it's small, it's two-sided, and on one side it has the metro map, and it superimposes on the metro map where you can access a safe abortion. It's tiny, you can stick it in your pocket, it's directions how to get there, and on the back side information. So that, I thought that was brilliant for an urban setting. So I think we're out of time. Are we okay? Okay.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.